when you are. May it please the court. Excuse me. My name is Alan Karsh, registration number 1620, and I'm representing the appellants. Your Honors, this case addresses a number of issues. I think the first of which is the most important issue is the failure of the trial court to review the circumstances of the judicial foreclosure sale that was conducted pursuant to an order of the trial court, which was issued October 22, 2012. At least since 1940, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized that courts of the United States must protect the rights of borrowers. Borrowers, particularly that are involved in judicial foreclosures. In the Gelkert case, which I cited in my brief, the Supreme Court recognized that constitutionally, mortgagees, lenders, are not entitled to more than payment in full. The Supreme Court therefore sought to protect mortgagees, or the borrowers rather, than the mortgagors, from actions of their lenders which resulted in windfall profits. Now, that was a case in 1940 before the U.S. Supreme Court. In 1960, the Colorado Supreme Court took up a similar situation, in a case very similar to ours, as a matter of fact. In the case of Handy versus Rogers, a case which I've also cited, the Colorado Supreme Court held that the court has the power to relieve a borrower from the inequitable and unconscionable effects of a sheriff's sale. The Handy court concluded that it is incumbent on a court of equity to supervise a sheriff's sale in a manner such as that required by Rule 120 of Colorado Rules of Civil Procedure. They said supervision of judicial foreclosure, the supervision of the judicial foreclosure did not occur in our action. There was no supervision whatsoever, and as a matter of fact, when the return of sale was submitted to the court, it was basically rubber stamped.
Well, wasn't part of the problem that your clients never bothered to notify the court of any concerns? I mean, there was an answer filed and then total silence from the defendants until many, many months after final judgment was entered.
Your Honor, that's correct.
Is there anything in the record that would explain that?
No, Your Honor, the situation was an unfortunate situation because when my clients, and it wasn't me, it was the attorney of record initially, they hired counsel, and when there was a motion for summary judgment filed, the notification, and this is in the record, the notification to my clients simply said a motion for summary judgment had been filed. It said nothing whatsoever about when an answer was due or what was required from that court.
I understand that, but your clients knew enough to hire a lawyer the first time, so I assume they knew enough to hire a lawyer when that one withdrew.
Well, and unfortunately they did not. They were negotiating with the plaintiff at the time, and according to what I understand, that is not in the record because there was no record after
sure.
that.
Well, whatever the reason is,
yes.
I mean, normally we don't review issues that are not preserved in the trial court. And here, nothing was done until months after final judgment was entered. Do we have jurisdiction at this point to even get into the issues?
Well, I think we do, Your Honor. And the reason that I think we do is because, again, the Handy court and courts thereafter have said it is incumbent upon the courts to look after and protect the interests of borrowers so that something of this nature does not happen. And the return, nobody knew this was going to happen until there was a return of sale. There was a judgment entered, but the plaintiff, in their action, they asked for judicial foreclosure of their deed of trust. Rather than take this to the public trustee, they asked for judicial foreclosure of their deed of trust. Therefore, they enacted the equitable powers of this court, and nothing was finalized until such time as the return of sale was filed, and it was very obvious to everybody that they had bid very much, well, I shouldn't say it was very obvious to everybody, but it's obvious to us, they bid very much under the price, the value of the property at the time.
Well, a couple things. One, you know, in the Handy case you cite, the bid price was like 2% of the actual value. Here it's a far cry. But secondly, I forgot the second piece. Excuse me.
That happens to me quite often.
Counsel, let me ask you this. You're arguing that the court did not review the foreclosure sale.
Correct.
And in fact, even though you might disagree with the court's conclusions and its order denying your motion to amend or alter the judgment, didn't the court review the circumstances there? And in its order, didn't it say and observe that is that there was a deficiency. It observed there was a deficiency, and it noted the differences in the appraised values that were submitted regarding the amount of the value of the property.
In which order are you referring to, Your Honor?
The order denying your motion to alter or amend.
Well, and but once again,
and then it determined that the equities did not favor your client. Is that right?
Well, and once again, Your Honor, my problem is this: the court did that basically on just a bare record. If there had been a review of the circumstances of the foreclosure sale, and if there had been a review of, in fact, what went on at the foreclosure sale, the plaintiff, once they had a judgment for $2,900,000, and they walked in and bid $833,000 for the property, they didn't give any reason whatsoever for bidding $833,000 for the property.
At that point, do they have to?
Well, I don't know why not, Your Honor. If the court of equity is going to protect the interests of the mortgagors, of the borrowers, then I think the court of equity should look into that and see if, in fact, there is a problem.
Well, let me ask you this: in this proceeding, did the plaintiffs try to collect a deficiency?
Oh, they are.
In this case?
Well, yes, sir. Absolutely. As a matter of fact.
And how is that?
Well, as a matter of fact, Your Honor, well, that's the interesting thing about this. When you say, are they trying to collect a deficiency?
Yes.
If you note in the answer brief filed herein, the plaintiff said the deficiency action is the case we filed in California to certify the judgment in this judgment in California and to go after the defendants in California. This was done after the foreclosure sale, so they knew how much was received at the foreclosure sale, $833,000, and it was done seeking the full amount of the judgment over $300,000 over $3 million in California. No credit given at all for the $833,000. So now they're saying this was the deficiency action. One of the things they have said here is we don't have the right to assert the 38-1066 as a defense to the deficiency, because that only happens when you're sued for a deficiency in the state of Colorado, rather than the normal procedure where someone goes to the public trustee, files a foreclosure, and then sues for a deficiency. What they've done very cleverly, Your Honor, is they've avoided that statute. They've gone completely around it by saying, you can't raise that statute now because we didn't sue you for deficiency here. We have sued you for an amount here in Colorado.
Counsel, didn't you in fact sue them for a deficiency? Didn't they in fact sue your client for a deficiency? They've got a $2.9 million judgment, and they want to collect that judgment. And all they've done in California, isn't it, is file to domesticate the judgment.
Oh, they've gone much further than that, Your Honor. The judgment has been certified in California.
Is this in the record? Because I couldn't find anything in the record.
Well, again, this was all after the record was submitted, because they did this, they filed out there, and then after we started this appeal, the judge out there has certified the judgment. He certified the full amount, and he has said he doesn't have the power to modify it. It's up to the court here to modify it.
But my point is, merely domesticating the judgment, which is what the record appears to show, all that is enforcing the judgment that was entered in this court.
That's correct.
In the court in
Adams County.
Adams County.
Yes. That's true. But so they're now trying, the collection procedures in California are ongoing. So they're trying to collect the deficiency. What you just said,
they're talking about collecting it. They're not suing for it. They're collecting it, aren't they?
What's the difference? I'm sorry. If you've already got a judgment for the deficiency.
I mean, do what you want. It would look to me that what happened here was a judgment was entered for $2.9 million.
Yes.
They got an $800,000 sale. So obviously there's a deficiency. They have a judgment. They can collect that in a variety of ways. They can try to collect it here. They can collect it in California. They can collect it in Hong Kong if there's assets there. But it's all the same case.
I understand that, Your Honor, but you know, you just said they sued us for a deficiency by getting $2.9 million here. They claim in their answer brief that they haven't sued us for a deficiency here in Colorado, and that's why we can't raise 38-1066.
Well, I'm suggesting something else, and you're resisting it, so that's fine. Go ahead.
No, I'm just simply saying what I'm saying is 38-1066 was enacted to protect the borrowers and protect their equity redemption. The Guilford case, the Handy case say you're supposed to try and protect the equity of redemption and protect the borrowers against an unconscionable situation. And I'm telling you that when we've got numbers flying all over the place here. They started with a lawsuit for $2,085,000, basically. That's what they said the balance was on the note at the time that they filed the action in May of 2012. By the time the case got to summary judgment, 5 months later, not even a full 5 months later, they're asking for $2,900,000. So we've gone up $900,000 in that period of time.
Pardon me for interrupting, yes, Mr. Karsh. No, I'm sorry to interrupt, and I don't want you to think I'm piling on here, because that's not my intent. But I want to go back to Judge Miller's initial question about jurisdiction, because okay. I wasn't clear on your answer, and I want to make sure that I am. It's the way I read the record, your clients did not respond to the motion for summary judgment, and the next thing that they file is not a notice of appeal, it's the 60B motion.
Correct.
Am I right about that?
That's correct.
I'm concerned about whether we have jurisdiction over this appeal, because I'm concerned that the final judgment occurred when the court said, all right, I grant summary judgment and then later go sell the property. And when the court did that, which I think was in October of 2012, I'm concerned that that is the date that started your clock ticking. So I'm worried about jurisdiction here. Can you help?
Yes, Your Honor, first of all, and I've got very little time, first of all, in order, before you could find out what your damages were in this case, because when there was judgment entered for $2,000,009, claimant was kind enough to ask that the court also allow them to judicially foreclose their deed of trust. Well, if you're going to judicially foreclose the deed of trust, how do you know how much you're going to owe the plaintiff ultimately until after the foreclosure sale is completed? So essentially, I don't think it's final by any means. As a matter of fact, my understanding of Rule 54 is you have to have finality of all claims. The second claim for relief wasn't final until such time as the return of sale was filed. I cite one of the cases in my brief where they say that there was an order for a deed to be executed after the judgment, and they said the case wasn't final until that deed was executed. I think the same thing happened here. Until such time as the sheriff's sale was concluded, the return of sale was submitted, and the quote, deficiency, which they're claiming now was not a deficiency they sued upon, the deficiency was set, there was no final judgment that from which we could appeal. I mean, we may not have appealed the case at all if, in fact, the property sold for the full amount of the note. We didn't know that until all of a sudden they go in the day of the foreclosure sale, and they bid $833,000, giving no explanation in their bid amount how they came up with that figure. As a matter of fact, they've stated that they have an appraisal for $1,270,000 on the property.
I'll just remind you, you have 2 minutes left.
I understand that. I'm going to reserve for rebuttal. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Jeff McClellan, registration number 45114, appearing on behalf of the appellees, Standard Insurance Company, Pet Al, who are plaintiffs below. May it please the court. While I hope to address three main issues today, the first and most important issue that I wish to address is Mr. Karsh's argument about an independent equitable action. It is unquestioned that the defendants failed to file an independent equitable action for relief from the trial court's order approving the foreclosure sale.
Did they have to? And what they filed was a motion for a judgment, a money judgment. I mean, they filed two claims. One, a money judgment, which they got, which your clients got for $2.99. And they also sought for equitable foreclosure of the deed of trust. Why would they have to bring a separate action in order to call upon the Court of Equity to resolve these issues?
Well, Mr. Karsh is ignoring the fact that the trial court did enter an order approving the foreclosure sale.
I agree.
And that it reviewed it before it entered its order, presumably, and that ended the action. There was nothing more.
So it was not final until the judge approved the actual sale? Is that your position?
No, our position is that the final judgment was entered upon the decree of foreclosure.
Okay.
And that's what Rule 105 provides. It says that it should provide, a decree of foreclosure should provide for a full and complete adjudication of all rights of all parties. So there was nothing more for the trial court to do on the claims for breach of note and for judicial foreclosure.
Well, Mr. Karsh, I think, is arguing that he would not have been able to appeal that judgment until the sale was complete, because he would not have known what, if any, deficiency judgment would exist until the sale was completed and approved by the court. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's just satisfaction on the judgment, Your Honor, in a sense. It's whatever the property sells for at foreclosure sale is just applied to the judgment. It doesn't actually reopen the judgment as Mr. Karsh suggests. So the trial court unquestionably entered its order approving the sale, and that ended its equitable review. They were then forced to file independent equitable action if they wanted to bring up further review by any court under the principles of equity.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. McClellan, but I'd like to ask you the same question that I asked Mr. Karsh. I'm concerned about our jurisdiction here. Do we have jurisdiction over this appeal? And if only part of it, which parts?
I believe you do have jurisdiction because Mr. Karsh filed a Rule 60 motion, and he has only appealed the denial of relief on that Rule 60 motion, which doesn't bring up the final judgment for your review. So regardless of the fact that the decree of foreclosure was the final judgment in this action, Mr. Karsh filed a Rule 60 motion. Whether that was timely or not, I would like to address later, but regardless, the trial court did consider it, and he did timely file an appeal of that denial.
That goes back, if I could follow up, please. At least for the 60B2 part, if that's not timely, do we have jurisdiction to resolve an appeal from the 60B2 part?
The denial of the Rule 60B2 motion, yes, or just filing it in the first place?
Do we have jurisdiction to review the trial court's decision to deny the 60B2 if the 60B2 was outside of the time limits?
I'm not sure I understand the distinction. I believe that the trial court definitely determined that the Rule 60B2 motion was untimely. That determination is a decision as a matter of law. So I would say that I think the court does have jurisdiction to determine if the trial court's determination that it was untimely was correct.
Okay. So if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is that, to follow up on Judge Bernard's question, we do have jurisdiction to rule on the 60B motion. However, we would not have jurisdiction to rule regarding the final judgment, the decree of foreclosure.
That's correct, Your Honor. And just to address Mr. Karsh's citation to the Colorado Supreme Court's opinion in Handy v. Rogers, that case is easily distinguishable from the present one in that the trial court there never actually confirmed the foreclosure sale. So it retained equitable jurisdiction to review the terms of that sale and issue equitable relief. Here, again, it is unquestioned that the trial court did enter an order approving the sale. That ended the action as far as the foreclosure sale is concerned.
Let me interrupt you again with another question. It's my understanding that Mr. Karsh is arguing that this proceeding is a deficiency action. And because it is a deficiency action, and there's a deficiency bid in the sale, that they were entitled to raise the defense under the statute, I forget the number of it right now, 3838-1066.
Yes, Your Honor.
How do you respond to that?
Well, Mr. Karsh has changed his argument over the course of this proceeding. In their own Rule 60 motion, they acknowledged that plaintiffs never sued the defendants on a deficiency.
Well, what happened, though? We're not bound by concessions. We're interested in them, but tell us what the law is and what the facts are.
So The plaintiff sued for a breach of note and judicial foreclosure. The summary judgment entered on October 22nd, 2012, for $2.9 million. That was the summary judgment order on the breach of note claim. And in that same order, the trial court granted judicial foreclosure. Subsequently, on October 25th, 2012, the trial court entered its decree of foreclosure. It is our position that that was the final judgment in this case, and it definitively established the in personam liability of the defendants. Then after that, there was a foreclosure sale, according to the decree of foreclosure. Bid was placed, there was a deficiency to remain, but that does not allow the defendants to reopen the underlying judgment.
But that was approved by the court, right?
Yes.
So this, the Adams County Court, District Court, approved the deficiency.
Correct.
So you went to the Adams County Court to get it to approve the deficiency, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And all you've done in California, and I'd like you to stay within the record rather than talk about future developments. All you've done in California is bring a proceeding to domesticate that judgment, correct?
Well, that is slightly incorrect, Your Honor. It's okay. Actually
so
the plaintiff's successor in interest that has domesticated the judgment. It was assigned the judgment from Colorado, which it then domesticated in California. And that's reflected in the record.
And that's, I mean, what I was able to find was a notice of filing a Colorado judgment. Is that basically what's happening?
That's correct.
Okay. So there's nobody sued anybody for a deficiency in a separate action?
No, in a sense, not. No, they tried to enforce a collection effort.
So when the California court ruled, as we've been somebody advised in the briefs, that you got to go to the Colorado court for relief, that's right. The California court doesn't have the ability to alter Colorado judgment, does it?
Well, again, that's not in the record, Your Honor. I don't know if they've raised that argument.
But whether or not they have, isn't that correct? The California court does not have jurisdiction to alter a Colorado judgment?
Again, because the deficiency is separate from the underlying judgment.
Why is that so? You got a $2.9 million verdict.
Yes, that's correct.
And there doesn't seem to be any dispute that the purchase sale was about $800,000 or $900,000.
That's correct.
So there's a deficiency.
Yes, that's correct.
And you're not waiving that, are you?
No, we're not.
In fact, you could, if Mr. Karsh's clients had a $2 million bank account, you could go after that, couldn't you?
I suppose so, Your Honor, yes.
And your clients probably would want to do that.
Yes.
They wouldn't have to bring a new action to sue for a deficiency because they already have a judgment on the deficiency.
That's correct. And again, because this was a judicial foreclosure, it doesn't follow the normal proceeding in a public trustee foreclosure, which results in the foreclosure sale results in a deficiency, which you then have to sue on a deficiency.
Right. So that's what 3838-1063 is really aimed at, isn't it? Public trustee sale, where there is no, the only action pending is the 120 motion, perhaps, and they say don't go to the 120 court, go file a separate action. Here that's not necessary because you have a dollar judgment.
That's correct.
And so these claims, assuming they were asserted timely, can be claimed. The court can, defendants can challenge the judgments, assuming they've done so timely, correct?
Well, under the plain language of the statute, it says that defense can only be raised when they are sued on a deficiency, which did not happen here.
Well, it did, because you just agreed that they've got a $2.9 million judgment. And that is enforceable. They don't have to bring a separate suit. In fact, if you brought a separate suit, it would probably be dismissed, wouldn't it?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because they could have filed an independent equitable action to challenge this.
No, you.
I'm sorry, if we had to bring a separate suit.
Why would you bring it? Neither you nor your successor have brought a separate action for a deficiency.
No, Your Honor.
I mean, when I say you, I mean your client.
Correct.
So it doesn't make sense in this context, where there already is a deficiency judgment that you can enforce.
It may not make sense in this particular context.
Well, that's the case we're talking about.
But what defendants are not stating is that they had ample opportunity to raise these arguments challenging the deficiency bid at the appropriate time. They could have participated in the foreclosure sale. They could have filed a timely objection to the confirmation of the sheriff's sale. They could have objected, and they could have raised the defense, or raised the defense in the California action, maybe the California court would have considered, and unquestionably, they could have filed an independent equitable action. That was entirely permitted. It's been a long-established rule in Colorado, and there's really no explanation as to why they have not. We raised this in our response to their Rule 60 motion. They've never filed an independent equitable action. They may be time-barred from doing that now, I don't know, but it's unquestioned that they could have done that, and they have yet to take advantage of that opportunity. So it's not as if they had no opportunity to challenge the bid price in the foreclosure sale. And the last argument I just wish to make is regarding the 60B2 question that you had, Judge. Again, because final judgment entered upon the entry of the decree of foreclosure, all of defendant's motions arguments regarding the judgment amount, those were not timely raised. Again, that was unquestionably after the six-month period had run from the entry of the decree of foreclosure, and so therefore the trial court correctly determined they were time barred. Thank you.
I believe that we've established essentially that they have sued on there's a suit on a deficiency. I mean, I don't see any other way to pronounce it than what you said, Judge Miller. We're being sued for a deficiency where they're trying to collect a deficiency, but we have not had the opportunity provided by 3838106 to argue about the deficiency because of the manner in which they handled this lawsuit. They got a judgment on the note first. They then asked for judicial foreclosure all within the same action. So the equitable powers of the court were already enacted by the plaintiff. And what we're simply asking the court to do is to have the court exercise its equitable power in reviewing the circumstances of the foreclosure sale and in determining whether or not there was, in fact, the bid was proper, whether, in fact, it was unconscionable, as I feel that we obviously feel it was, or what the situation is. Now, you know, there hasn't been much discussion here also of the 60B5 situation where we believe that these are extraordinary circumstances, and they are because of the amount of money that they're seeking. They're seeking, they started out with $2 million, they've gone to $2.9 million. Now they're seeking $3 million in California, and that's in the record, and without having given any credit whatsoever for that which happened at the foreclosure sale. To that extent, I think that there are extraordinary circumstances, and I think that this has to be reviewed by the court. I think the court has failed to do so. In that respect, I think the court has committed error. Is there anything else I can respond to?
Is there any point in time at which your clients would have been barred from bringing their Rule 60 motions, 60B motions?
Yes, Your Honor, if it wasn't, that would have been a reasonable period of time.
And your contention that this was a reasonable period
absolutely.
Of time?
Absolutely. I believe so, Your Honor. Once they found out what the amount of the deficiency was as of the end of March, when they found out
they had no obligation to follow the proceedings that were going on in a case in which they were parties and find out what was going on.
Well, even if they did, they would have found that out in February, and this was filed within 4 months thereafter, 5 months thereafter. And I think that's a reasonable period of time. It took some time to get this all together. Thank you, General.
Thank you, Counsel. Before thank both counsel for your arguments. Your arguments will be helpful to the court in reaching a decision. In that regard, the matter now stands submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.